Right, so basically same announcements as before. Final project proposal is the next kind of big thing, April 13th. So I think that's next Sunday. Then likewise, Muddy's Point and concept checks and mini projects all due then from Unit 6. So moving on to Unit 7. So I've tried to streamline Unit 7 a little bit. I'm going to teach in kind of a different order and in a slightly different kind of grouping than I usually do, in order to try to squeeze it a little smaller so that I can manage to fit in just a little bit of that Unit 8 on in interacting particle systems and cellular automata. So that's the plan. So Unit 7 is focused on, you know, the one of the most popular, one of the famous bio-inspired architectures in computation, the neural network, or so just generally neural computation and learning. So I'm going to cover some sort of fundamentals on both learning in biological systems as well as learning in machine learning and how they connect today. And then we're going to sort of talk about the neurons, some neural networks, eventually get to some unsupervised approaches, and then finally spiking is where we're going to round things out, which will the neuromorphic kind of bring us back to the neuron. So that's kind of the plan here. So no need to sort of like this map is not anything you have to like take down. It's just kind of a map of where we're going. All right, so where are we starting? Well, the idea here is that we have to sort of first say what is learning, and this applies, you know, to what extent does this term apply to machine learning as well as biological learning? Where do they kind of overlap, and so on? So at least in biology, and I would say I'd argue also in automation systems and computer science, that learning is a process. It is a change in behavior or internal model or predictive ability based on experience. Key emphasis word there is change. So that's the process. Now, how you know what does that process lead to? Well, that's the product. So learning changes your memory. Memory is a persistence of that change over time. And there are different time scales of memory. We don't often think about time scales in a lot of machine learning settings because we only have kind of one time scale in mind, or we try to adjust that time scale. But in biological systems, this is a key feature of learning and memory is the time scale. So there are three time scales that we talk about in biological systems. Working memory, which is very, very short, seconds or milliseconds, up to maybe as much as half a minute. So your working memory keeps track of what you're doing right now, which allows you for some local continuity. There's then short-term memory, which is seconds to a few minutes, up to maybe half an hour. And these things can be reinforced. So you can have a short-term memory that keeps track of like, well, where was the, you know, I was looking for coffee and all the coffee stands were out of, you know, just drip brew except for this one. So you have to remember which one has the drip brew, and maybe that you remember that for as much of a half hour. But if you go back there periodically, then you might keep remembering that, okay, all day that coffee stand was the one that had drip brew that I wanted to go to. So that's my short-term memory. And then eventually those things get consolidated, and that's a term we'll talk about, into long-term memory, which is hours to lifetime. Your long-term memories can decay, but they themselves get reinforced throughout your life, become more permanent. There are certain types of memory that are outside of the scope of this class, like imprinting, for example, that naturally last a lifetime even without continuous reinforcement. There are special little areas of your brain that during the right period of your life, if you get the right type of events, you'll remember that event forever. There are other weird types of biological memory too, like taste aversion, where you actually can memorize things very, very quickly for very long periods of time. So like if you've ever you know, if they've ever eaten something and then even a day later had a reaction where you've thrown up or you vomited because of that, then there's a special circuit in the vertebrate brain that will make that association, even though they're not directly linked to each other, make it very quickly and then make it very much persistent. And so that's why if you were sort of, if in college you became familiar with a particular type of libation or drink that was not very was unsettling to you the first time you had it, you might remember that for your entire life. So there are these special circuits that exist in biological brains, which go beyond these definitions, but these pretty much cover most of the memory that we talk about from a day-to-day basis. Now, I bring these up because these not only differ in terms of time, they also differ in terms of cost of implementation. So when we think about what types of memory, say, why don't we only have one type of memory? And when you write a computer program, when you write a predictive tool to predict the next word in a sentence, you will find that there are aspects of timescales of memory that are important. We may mention when we get into recurrent neural networks that before large language models became so popular, then the best way that Google had to predict your next word was using a recurrent neural network it called long short-term memory. And it established these longer timescales of memory that allowed it to do more. So it's interesting that some types of memories are functional because they're forgotten so quickly, and some types of memories are functional because they're remembered for long amounts of time. So you don't want to remember everything forever. That may not be that useful. Remembering that you happened to find a nut under that tree this morning doesn't necessarily help you in a month from now. But remembering that that nut was there a few minutes ago tells you that if you want to look for another nut, then maybe go back under that tree. So certain memories are more functional at certain timescales. And then, as we'll see, that this type of memory implemented in the brain uses the fewest amount of resources. This type of memory implemented in the brain uses the most amount of resources, involves the most amount of complexity in how it's built inside your brain. So, if you do need long-term memory, then that long-term memory is going to cost you a lot in terms of, if you might need to eat another muffin in the morning in order to make that memory. So it's going to cost you energetically. It's also going to require different circuits inside your brain. There are additional circuits like that imprinting that I haven't even written up here, like that's like lifelong memory that doesn't need to be reinforced. And those types of things, those also they may not require be quite as costly in terms of energetics, but they do require a special purpose circuit for that. And then there are things that, if you don't need to remember it, like if it doesn't change over your lifetime, if it doesn't change over many generations, then in that case, you might not need to have a circuit to remember that because it can just be built into your hardware at that point. So it's almost like it's generational memory, in which case it becomes extremely cheap at the individual level because you don't have to have any changes that you have to keep track of, but it becomes more complex in that you have to now build it into special purpose hardware that is, specialized for that particular environment. So we can extend memory even further than this, but these three time scales are cover a lot. All right. So any questions what I mean by that? Working versus short term versus long term. I also throughout here may call this STM. And this one LTM, and we'll see those abbreviations. Okay. And then plasticity. So process, product, mechanism. Learning is the process, memory is the product, plasticity is the mechanism. So sometimes you see these things thrown out around almost interchangeably. They do have some slight differences here. They're kind of different levels of explanation. What do we mean by mechanism here is this is the neural and synaptic reconfiguration that enables the memory that makes persistence possible. This is also called neuroplasticity. You can imagine there's other forms of plasticity, other ways your body can remember changes. We're focusing on the things that happen in your brain, so neuroplasticity. That implements different types of memory in different ways. So just like there are these three different types of working memory, short-term memory, long-term memory, there are effectively three different neuroplasticity mechanisms that when you make a working memory or when you make a short-term memory or you make a long-term memory, it's a different process that goes on in your head tied to sort of, and we're going to talk a little bit about each one of those, how you build these things out of wetware. So learning is the process, memory is the product, plasticity is the mechanism. This also applies to machine learning, where you're just implemented in a slightly different hardware. So when we talk about machine learning, there's good old-fashioned AI, good old-fashioned machine learning that is doing learning, and it is forming memories for sure, but it may not be using a neural network to do that. It may be using some other underlying process. So these three layers also apply when we talk about machine learning, not just biological learning. Okay, questions about these distinctions? Great. All right, so let's talk about neuroplasticity a little bit. So I'm getting a few of our terms right. So this is my depiction of a neuron. If you want to say what are the stuff that might be useful for you to sketch, well, that it's got this cell body that's just got a bunch of these dendrites here. So it's just got these little spikes that come off here. And then it has this long axon to this little whip-like tail over here that I'm calling this axon terminal. So this is a single neuron. There are different types of neurons. This is kind of a canonical basic neuron. The pyramidal neuron is a neuron you often hear about, which this is sort of shaped like a pyramid where there's this tree of dendrites that grows out over here. So there's some basal dendrites and some of these tree are the dendritic arbor that comes out of it. And so it kind of looks like a pyramid. Or I guess it looks maybe like a pyramid like this. We are not going to go into that level of detail. Just know there's not just one type of neuron. There's a whole bunch of types of neurons that are specialized for different things, but they all have a lot that's in common. And the basic idea here is that they're going to be integrating information in the cell body in ways we'll talk about here. And then once they've reached a sort of decision point, then they're going to transmit a signal down the axon, and then that axon is going to communicate that signal via hormones, neurotransmitters, to other neurons that are downstream. So there are upstream neurons that communicate to it, and it gathers all that info. It then generates a signal, which is then communicated to downstream neurons. There are electrical signals that flow within the neuron, which we'll talk about. And then there are chemical signals that flow between the neurons. There are some electrical coupling when you get neurons really close together, then just like just like two wires being close together, you can get some coupling between them, but most coupling that is inside the brain is chemical coupling, where the electrical signal goes down through the body of the neuron, but then it then causes a bunch of hormones to be dumped into a little gap, which then communicates via chemistry that this signal has it has been received by the other neuron, which is down here. So I can start erasing some of that. So here is my input from my upstream neuron. That is an axon from the upstream neuron, and we're communicating down here to this downstream neuron, which this is its cell body, and that's its nucleus there. And the gap in between them is what we refer to as a synapse. So I put little dots in between them. Those are the so-called neurotransmitters. They're literally a type of hormone, which, hormones are just chemical signals between cells, and a very special type of hormone is a neurotransmitter. Different neurons are based on different neurotransmitters, like glutamate and things like that. And so there are in these chemicals, they basically are emitted from one side and received by the other. And that generates a temporary stimulus to all of these dendrites that are on these neurons that can accumulate. And again, once they reach some threshold, then they can trigger their own release of these neurotransmitters. And so that is our basic neuron. The thing that transmit or it's down the body is something that we refer to as an action potential. So the idea behind an action potential is that The whole neuron, like every cell in your body, sits at a negative potential, at negative whatever, 70 millivolts or something like that. And there is some threshold that I've depicted, and these details are not that important. It's just sort of if you're interested in how this works. So your neuron sits at a resting potential that's like minus 70 millivolts. And when these chemicals are received at these dendrites, it's causing the neuron to slightly depolarize. So it raises its voltage a little bit. And when it crosses some threshold at like minus 50 millivolts, it starts, it's in engineering, we would refer to it as a monostable multivibrator, a trigger. It triggers this so-called action potential, which causes the neuron to raise its voltage into the positive range for a small period of time, and then plummet into this negative range, where during this negative range, it actually doesn't respond to signals. You need a much, much stronger signal to generate another action potential until it finally comes back to the resting range. So this little period underneath here, where it's less responsive, that's called a refractory period. When we get to spiking neural networks, that will become more important. But that's the reason it's sort of shaped like this. And this pulse of voltage, you can think of it as traveling down this axon so that when it's finally received at the nerve endings, at the axon terminal, then that little pulse is what causes these neurotransmitters to be released and that input to be received at the next neuron. So that is the basic action of how neurons communicate with each other, by summing inputs, activating, generating inputs for others. Questions about that basic idea? Okay, so we refer, since we call that the synapse, when we're looking at a synapse, the neuron upstream to it, we call presynaptic. The presynaptic axon, the presynaptic neuron, and then downstream from it, we call it postsynaptic. So rather than saying upstream, downstream, presynaptic, postsynaptic. So these neurons, what sort of scale are we talking about? Well, in the human brain, there's about 10 to the 11th neurons in the human brain. And that's usually, I think, not that surprising. Like, it just sounds like a big number. But we always draw these diagrams showing one neuron connected to another. But what I think is really impressive is when you think, when they talk about a vertebrate brain or even an invertebrate brain, each neuron doesn't have one or two connections. It has anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 connections to other neurons. So this is a mess of network here, where this one neuron, it is going to have axons from a whole bunch of others. And likewise, it may terminate on a whole bunch of others. There can be connections that are, there can be couplings at different levels here. There is a, it, when a neuron can connect to itself, so you can actually have one of these axons terminate back onto the same neuron, and you get what's called an autapse, where it has this recurrency where it can end up causing, when it fires, it makes itself more likely to fire later. So it gets a sort of positive feedback on itself. And so there, this is extremely complex networks that are formed. It's not just one neuron connecting to three or four other neurons. It's a big, ugly mess. If you were to take a neuron out and pull it out of the brain, then it would just have this huge, tangle of other neurons connected to it. And, and then that, like I was saying, all of that activity gets summed in the dendrites, summed from the dendrites in the cell body. And then from there, if you get enough signal, you generate an action potential, which travels down the axon and then stimulates another neuron, which, if it doesn't have any other stimulus, it might stop there. But if it has enough stimulus from other neurons, then it might, or if it's just really sensitive, then it might itself generate an action potential, and so on and so forth. And that's how these biological neural networks work. So that's what we're, our own neural networks are inspired by this, as we'll see as we move on in the unit. So any questions about this basic structure here? I say basic not because it's easy. I say basic because this is like the canonical neuron-to-neuron connection. Like you say, things get more complicated when you get into the other types of neurons and so on. We could also talk about how just even there are local neurons and there are projection neurons, and so there are your brain is organized in a hierarchy where you've got neuropils, you've got these little units, functional units of your brain that have local connections, local neurons, but then they also have a few projection neurons that connect to other neuropils, other organizational units of your brain. And those are very long connections. So you have short neurons that just communicate locally, and you have long neurons which plug into other units elsewhere. And so we often talk about where do things project to? And that means, where are what information is getting from your optic, from your olfactory bulb, where does it project to? So when I smell an odor, like the weird musty odor that's coming from that vent, when I smell that odor, that information gets processed by my olfactory bulb, but then it then has to get that information in the rest of my brain. So we can talk about local neurons that I talk about the operation of your olfactory bulb, but then projection neurons that then once it's done some processing, then take that information and project it to other parts of my brain where I use it in my higher order decision making. So there's all sorts of categories of neurons we can talk about too when we talk about architecture of the brain. So that's just, again, a little bit out of scope, but we'll return to some of those ideas, especially as we get to spiking neurons later. Okay, so now that we know the neuron, how do you implement these three types of memory within these neurons? So remember, we have working memory. So working memory at millisecond to second time scale, a lot of times this is just sustained firing. There's actually no changes inside the neuron, but it's like you've got a bunch of these recurrent networks. And so if you get a bunch of firing, then sometimes you get enough recurrency to sort of make the firing have a longer tail so that you get a group of neurons that don't just fire and turn off, they fire and reinforce themselves. And so they can stay on for a little bit longer. So you might get very short-term changes in membrane sensitivity. So I mentioned that in this neuron over here, these things have membranes which sort of which are around these synapses, and those membranes, are what interact with these neurotransmitters. So there can be, like, when you've been slammed, a neurotransmitter has been slammed into a receptor, then it's possible that in the very, very short term, that receptor might become more or less likely to snag on to additional neurotransmitters immediately after. So there can be some inertia in the membrane that can change the sensitivity of the neuron. And that's really what which memory is an altered sensitivity of neurons. How easy is it to get that neuron to fire an action potential? So in working memory, you don't have any real changes to the inside of the neuron itself. So it's not very costly. There's not a lot of energy that has to go into restructuring the neuron, but you do get these local interactions between neurons, which just persist a little bit longer than you might expect if it was just a neuron in a petri dish. That's how working memory is. Things get more exciting when we go to short-term memory. This is seconds to minutes time scales. Here, we actually do see alterations to proteins inside the neuron. So the neuron has proteins which these are what do we call post-translational changes. So we're not building new proteins, but as things fire, there's the proteins inside the neuron which make that neuron more likely to fire or less likely to fire. Those proteins will interact with other proteins and they might temporarily bolt on little modifications, things like phosphorylations and stuff like that. Things again are outside of the scope of this class, but little chemical modifiers that are temporary little tags that that make them more likely or less likely to generate an action potential. So and they'll stick on there for a while, but then they can then pop off if they're not reinforced. So this creates sort of in the, it's kind of, if we're thinking about it, it's if kind of in the down here, like in sort of this area of the neuron, where it's like the business end of where the action is generated, that becomes more sensitive, not due to the generation of more proteins, but due to just temporary modifications of proteins that are already floating around in the neuron. That is how your short-term memory works, is you're making the inside each, and the person who figured this out got a Nobel Prize. So the inside each cell, there are little components of the cell that get temporary modifications, and that is your short-term memory. If you manipulate those neurons to prevent those modifications, you will get rid of someone's short-term memory. But then that sort of then suggests, well, then how do I get my long-term memories? Well, what long-term memories are actual restructuring of the neuron itself. This is requires synthesizing new proteins. So you actually engage the nucleus of a neuron by and you turn on new genes and you say, I need more proteins to help me add new dendritic spines, or I need to add more receptors to the area end of the synapse. So you're actually building new hardware on the outside of the neuron itself, reshaping the neuron. That is very costly. It takes a lot of energy. This is the reason why your brain uses so much energy, because all of this learning, this reshaping, it's like growing new limbs every time you learn something for a long period of time. So the metabolic costs of this, not very big. I mean, you still have to trigger an action potential that is a little costly to generate this little spike. The metabolic costs here a little bit larger. You have to sort of, bolt a couple of temporary things on to some molecules that then get popped off later. Here, it's very metabolically costly. You actually have to reshape a cell to add things off of that cell to make. And in all of these cases, you're making the neurons more sensitive to triggering, to more likely to trigger or less likely to trigger. So you can actually learn the other way around too. So, but you're changing the sensitivity of the neurons to how often they trigger. Now, one of the cool, once you sort of realize this, then it starts giving you sort of perspectives on interesting organisms that are out there. So, for example, there's this very, very tiny parasitoid wasp called the genus is Megafragma. Doesn't matter. It's kind of outside the scope of this class, but it's so small. How many people know what a fruit fly is? So little, tiny, annoying fly. Imagine a fruit fly brain. So really tiny. Imagine the optic lobe of a fruit fly brain. So a piece of the fruit fly brain. Now put an entire wasp inside that lobe. That's how big, and it's a fully functional wasp. It flies, it searches for mates, it does all of the things that you'd expect a fly to do, but it is smaller than the optic lobe of a fruit fly. Very, very tiny insect. Only lives for about a week. Now, its adult form is bigger than its juvenile form. So egg larvae pupae. Its adult form is smaller than the pupae. So it develops, again, egg larvae pupae, and then from the pupal form to this adult form, it sort of pops out as this very, very tiny wasp. And in that process of going into its mature form, it has a brain of, I forget, like 900 neurons or something like that. 90% of those neurons during that development process, they lyse out. So they pop out like a pimple, the nucleus of their cells. So, it, and then if you stain the brain of this wasp, so you can see the remaining nuclei. It looks like a chocolate chip cookie. There's like a giant brain that is just all non-nuclear, and then a couple of nuclei and a few remaining neurons. So what that tells you is that in order to form long-term memories, you need the nuclei because you need to turn on genes. So what that tells you is during development, because it only lives for like 7 days as an adult. So during development, it pumps out enough proteins as a developing wasp to get enough kind of fuel, protein fuel, into the neuron so that it can support working memory and short-term memory, and to do all of the things it needs to do to basically live through its reproductive cycle. And it doesn't need long-term memory, at least not a significant amount of it. And so it can build a brain pretty much entirely out of short-term memory, which I think is kind of cool. And that is what allows it to be so small. Other insects get that small by shoving their brain into their necks. So when you actually look at the anatomy of these things, then your brain's up here, but you can imagine it going into your chest. A lot of insects, when they get that small, they need to maintain the size of their brain, and that's the only way we can do it. You can't do that as a wasp because you need your neck to be able to move as a wasp. So these wasps have gotten that small by going the other way. They've made their neurons tinier by popping out the nuclei, which I think is just so cool. I just want to give you an idea of how this hardware works, and hopefully that's a nice motivational example. So any questions about that? It's like these different mechanisms for your three different types of memory. Okay. All right, so how do you get long-term memory in real biological systems? So there, if effectively, short-term memory, which you're using all the time, is going to be consolidated into long-term memory in a later process. And so there are these memory traces, which are basically, there are, you can imagine when you make a decision based on short-term memory that there's a certain sequence of neurons that fire. We're going to call that a memory trace. And certain memory traces that are pretty important to you, like that, oh, that coffee shop, that I had a very good experience with the coffee at that shop. So in my short-term memory, I'm going to remember that there's good coffee at that shop. Now, throughout the day, if I keep going back to that and I keep reinforcing that memory, then that memory may become a long-term memory. And so there's a memory trace that keeps being firing, and then your brain remembers when these short-term memories are continually re-fired, or that where they keep up and up again, and then that becomes your long-term memory. So how does that happen? So one thing that happens is so-called synaptic tagging. If a neuron keeps firing over and over again, it will bolt on a little temporary flag on the synapse so that a process later, turns out while you're sleeping, will go through and be likely to trigger the reshaping process of that synapse to make it permanent. That's one way it happens. Even when that synaptic tagging doesn't happen, your short-term memories, even when they don't seem conscious, there's residual bits of that short-term memory that during sleep, your brain goes through a process, particularly during slow wave sleep, where it just starts activating neurons in your brain at a low level. And if your neurons have a slight tendency to, an increased sensitivity, so those short-term memories are still kind of hidden there. The ghosts of those short-term memories, those will be more likely to be fired when this process of just energizing your whole brain goes on during this slow wave sleep. And that is so-called reactivation or replay. And things that are important enough that they maintain these ghosts, even though you don't seem conscious of them when you go to sleep, those that get reactivated, it's almost as if you've gone through calling up that short-term memory again, over and over again, but it's happening while you're asleep. And that can then make it much more likely to trigger the synaptic reshaping to make them long-term memory. This is also thought to be one of the things that causes dreaming. So if you've ever had dreams where it seems like, huh, there were elements of my day that seemed to be replayed in my dreams, one of the thoughts behind that is that it's actually a side effect of this reactivation process as your memories are being consolidated from short-term to long-term memory. So you can put electrophysiological measurements on a mouse that has run a maze earlier in the day, and you can then watch that mouse run the maze during sleep, as this process goes on. So that's what we mean by reactivation or replay. So the resulting memory traces from those short-term memory that are more likely to be consolidated in the long-term memory, again, generally during sleep. And that actually now I've got colleagues, I'm on a project right now where we're studying sleep in honeybees that are developing artificial neural networks that themselves are better at consolidation using a process that is very similar to sleep. So when you've got a neural network that has to learn everything once and then it's done, then that's fine. But if you've got a neural network that has to be deployed into the world on a robot or something like that, and has to learn something and then learn something else and then learn something else, it turns out that sequential learning like that is really bad for modern neural networks. It's very easy to forget previous things you've learned whenever you learn a new thing. So you need a way to partition things up in the neural network so that when you learn a new thing, it doesn't screw up the old thing. And computational neuroscientists think that's what's going on during sleep, is that your brain is actually partitioning things up, making space for these different memories. And so now there are replay and sleep-based processes for continual learning artificial neural networks that effectively put the at some point in the learning process will temporarily put the neural network to sleep in order to make it easier for it to learn a second task without clobbering the first task. So we may someday have agents running around that these robotic agents will periodically go to sleep. Now, we know that there's animals out there that put half their brain to sleep at a time because they can't afford to put their whole brain to sleep because otherwise they get eaten. And so it doesn't mean that a robot is going to need to actually take a nap and just, it's like, oh, what's Jimmy the robot doing over there? Oh, he has to take a nap. He's sleeping. It'd be much more like this process could go on while the robot is operating, but maybe it's operating in a degraded mode, like defragging your hard disk is something you used to have to do with your computer all the time. So there might need to be a defragging of your brain that goes on, but it can go on kind of behind the scenes. But still, it's a little bit like those animals that put half their brains to sleep at a time so they can still operate. Anyways, that's how we get long-term memory, and that's how sleep is involved. And that's one of the things that's on sort of on the bleeding edge of lifelong learning and continual learning is how do you make neural networks sleep? All right, any questions about that? Consolidation. Okay. So synaptic plasticity. So this is finally getting to kind of training. So we'll talk about how we train artificial neural networks currently. And how they're, it's not like this in most cases until we get sort of towards the end of the more like to neuromorphics and so on. But there's still a lot of inspiration that comes from these. So we think that behind, like at the very basis of most learning and biological neural networks is so-called Hebbian learning, which is implemented by something we call spike timing dependent plasticity or STDP. We're going to talk more about this when we get into spiking neural networks later, but you've probably heard this phrase fire together, wire together. That is kind of the definition of Hebbian learning. And it's this idea that if you have a presynaptic, if you think about the association between presynaptic and postsynaptic firing, so if you've got neurons that happen to fire roughly at the same time, then their synapses will that in between them will tend to be reinforced to make it easier for them to fire later. So, as we'll talk about later in the unit when we talk about spiking neural networks, this STDP basically is going to be that if you frequently have a presynaptic neuron fire and then a postsynaptic neuron fire, you'll get an increase in the sensitivity of that synapse. But if it's the other way around, where if you get the postsynaptic neuron will fire and then the presynaptic, you get a decrease in sensitivity. That's STDP, which again is just an implementation of this general Hebbian idea. Fire together, wire together. If they fire roughly in agreement, then the synapse is strengthened. So it'll be more likely that they will fire together in the future. And that will, at the lowest level, will strengthen the weights or the connections between these neurons at these synapses. It's fast, it's local, it's automatic, it's unsupervised. I have not used the word reward anywhere in here. It just happens that, when the neurons happen to fire together, the synapses become more sensitive. When they fire sort of out of sync, then they become less sensitive. Questions about that? Is it clear what I mean by Hebbian learning, fire together, wire together? We're just increasing sensitivity when they fire at the same time, decreasing sensitivity when they fire out of sync. That's, we think, at the basis of it all. Now, we know that learning is more complicated than that. And so I'm going to add to that something we call neuromodulation. So, neuromodulation, you might have heard of different biogenic amines like dopamine, octopamine. There's others that are in these families. There's other neuromodulators, vasopressin, et cetera, et cetera. These are chemicals that are global chemicals that where your brain will become awash with them for short periods of time. And while your neurons are baking in this soup, this chemical soup, their sensitivity to fire changes just while they're in the soup. Once the soup dries up, once it gets sort of absorbed, goes away, their sensitivity will go back to whatever it was. But it allows them to be more sensitive and to fire more often or less often based on what basically just changes their sensitivity. So it might make them less sensitive, might make them more sensitive, but it modulates their sensitivity while they're in the soup. And because of Hebbian learning, it's going to change their firing patterns and that will change synaptic weights. So this modulates learning. So if you can get the brain to, like, let's say, for example, you can get the brain to be washed over with a biogenic amine that like dopamine that makes it more likely for things to fire. Well, then maybe during that temporary point where the brain is awash with that, you'll learn more quickly. Maybe connections will be formed more quickly. And then once it goes away and those connections are still there, now you've got this new plasticity, and maybe those memories will now be more likely to then those short-term memories that were just formed will be more likely to turn to the long-term memories because you've had a lot more of them being activated. So that's why it modulates this activity, changes the sensitivity of neurons and synapses. It adds value. It can allow you to sort of say, certain neurons, you'll suddenly focus on certain things. It might add salience. Certain parts of your sensory experience will pop out a little bit more, and that will change how you learn from them. Or it just generally it changes your attention. You start attending more to your senses as opposed to not attending. And then that changes the context over learning. And what causes, these neuromodulation? They're triggered by lots of things. One of the things they're triggered by is reward. So if you do receive a tasty treat, then your brain will get doused in a little bit of this neuromodulator. And so this sets up for potential interactions with the world, where if you do something that causes your brain to get doused in a chemical, which makes Hebbian learning happening more quickly, then the thing that caused your brain to get doused in that chemical, you may learn to seek that thing out. Because whatever caused you, say, oh, that thing that looks a particular color, I'm going to go touch that thing that looks a particular color. If you then get a reward, you'll suddenly realize that, oh, like it'll be more likely for those connections that relate to seeing that color and touching that color, those connections will be more likely to occur. That will be more likely to form a memory. So neuromodulation provides us rewards which make certain learning more likely than other learning. So these two things get combined. They can be triggered by other things, emotion, novelty. So you see something new, your brain's like, oh, it goes into learning mode. It like suddenly there's a neuromodulator which then gets released in your brain, and then suddenly you're in a different learning context than you were before. So this can influences the later formation of LTM, like I was just mentioning. If you had a short-term memory that might have only been recalled once, Because it's just so slow to use it. But now that you've made the sensitivity of your brain higher, then suddenly that short-term memory might be more likely to be triggered over and over again. And so the neuromodulator makes that short-term memory more likely to then formed in a long-term memory. So I want to emphasize long-term memory happens later, hours later, usually during sleep. And so neuromodulation doesn't directly affect your long-term memory, but it does make your short-term memory frequencies change. And that may then cause certain short-term memories to be more likely to be tagged for long-term memory that will be consolidated later. All right, so that's kind of our, that just kind of summarizing here that you have immediate effects on short-term memory and then potential effects later on long-term memory. That's how heavy learning and neuromodulation. These two tools basically form the basis of all learning that we do in wetware, in our biological brain. So any questions about what I mean by these two things? Heavy learning and neuromodulation. There are lots of neuromodulators, so I'm just binning them all into one group. Some are neuromodulators do more of X, some are neuromodulators do more of Y, some are positive, some are negative. There's a bunch of them, and your brain releases them at different events. So certain types of events, you get one, other types of events, you get others. It's a very complicated set of global signals that are released, but very important. Okay, so now what's what are the types of learning? So we're moving toward getting to biological or from biological learning to machine learning. So the first thing that is often confused for learning, but it's not really learning, is something we call sensory adaptation. So right now I'm wearing a shirt. When I put this shirt on, I definitely knew immediately that I had just put the shirt on, but until right now, where I just become, directed my attention to it, I had not noticed that I had been, that the shirt is on me because it is a constant stimulus on my nerve endings in my peripheral nervous system, in my arms and my chest, my torso, and so on. My brain is not ignoring the shirt. The nerves are ignoring the shirt. That's what we call sensory adaptation, where if you have a constant stimulus, like, if I were to just go and lean on this table, I would feel the table underneath my hand, but if I stayed here for a few minutes, I would stop feeling the table. My brain isn't forgetting the table. My hand is stopping sending signals about the table. That's what we refer to as sensory adaptation. It feels like a type of learning. It makes learning better because it helps us focus on the important things, but we don't call it learning because it happens at the periphery. It doesn't happen in your head. All right, so then the next that what the first type of learning then that we'll then focus on that seems related is non-associative learning. So these are changes to the response to one stimulus. So the one stimulus here is what makes it non-associative. And so this is going to seem very similar to what I just said about sensory adaptation. Habituation is a decrease in the response to a particular stimulus that is repeated. So this is not like for example, if every time students from the next class open that door, I will notice it the first time. The second time, I'll probably still notice it, but if it happens every minute, I eventually just tune it out. That's habituation. And so that's different than sensory adaptation. So sensory adaptation, it's a constant stimulus and in my hand, it's happening in my hand. Habituation is actually happening in my head, is that the signal's generated, it hits my brain, but my brain says there's nothing going on there. And I just stop paying attention to it. Now, sensitization, eventually someone opens that door and they slam it shut. When they slam it shut, that stimulus is much higher than it used to be. And suddenly I might freak out. And then for the rest of the class, I'll be looking at that door. So the sudden increase in the stimulus is sensitization. So the habituation tunes down your response and the sensitization tunes it up. It's not necessarily linked. I mean, it isn't linked at all to reward or anything else. You're not associating anything. It's just adjusting your brain's attention to stimulus based on how informational that stimulus is. So if it's repeated, the information as like zero bits because it's sort of predictable. And so when I get that stimulus, it happened exactly what I predicted it. So it's kind of like if I were to be able to predict that stimulus and it keeps happening against the pattern, I just ignore it. But if it suddenly happens in a very unpredictable way, like wow, that was a lot louder than I expected, then I start paying attention to that stimulus, that sensitization. That's what I mean by non-associative. So any questions what I mean by non-associative learning? Habituation sensitization. All right, so then I've got my associative learning, the big ones here. So I've got more detail on the next page. If you've taken a Psych 101 course, probably this is all review, but these are important. These are going to map to machine learning concepts that are important to us. And so associative learning is the association of two stimuli or the association of a stimulus and a response. So we have two versions of that. We have classical conditioning, where we have an existing response to an existing stimulus, and we copy that response to a new stimulus. That's classical conditioning. And I will have that diagrammed out here on the next slide. And then we've got operant conditioning, where you're it, so classical conditioning is response based. Here's a stimulus. What response do you get out? Here's a stimulus you weren't paying attention to. Here's a response that I got you to do to that stimulus. Operant conditioning is behavior first. It's not stimulus first. So here you're actually trying to learn a new behavior or change the frequency in a behavior. And in order to do that, you're applying punishment or reward, punishment or reinforcement. And so here the you could call it the stimulus comes after the behavior. Like, oh, you did something I want you to do, I'm going to reward you. Or, oh, you did something I don't want you to do, I'm going to punish you. So here stimulus comes first, here stimulus comes second, classical versus operant. And I'll show a diagram of that in the next one. And then the last one that I want to mention is latent learning, which is again important for a machine learning fundamental here. This is retention of information without reinforcement. The common example, famous experiment, where you send, you've got a group of rats and you put a smelly piece of cheese at the end of a maze and you see how well they find the cheese in the maze. Another group of rats, you just release them in the maze without cheese. And then after they've been walking around for a while, then you bring them back to the start of the maze, put the cheese there, and see how fast they find the cheese. The rats that had prior experience with the maze find the cheese much faster. That's an example of latent learning. There's no reinforcement, but their brain is retaining information about the maze that becomes useful later. So it's information the rat didn't know it needed. It's just information that just naturally got retained that then later became useful for later tasks, is so-called latent learning. All right, so before I drill down into these two, and then we go to machine learning. Any questions about these basic learning paradigms, the fundamentals here of biological learning? Okay. All right. So let's drill down into associative learning because these are the tricky ones, and we want to make sure we understand these. So this is also called associative learning or associative conditioning. These are both types of conditioning, Pavlovian conditioning versus Skinnerian conditioning. So Pavlov was the classical conditioning one. This is the one that came up first. And again, I would summarize this as copying a, and I'll define these, an unconditioned response from an unconditioned stimulus to a conditioned stimulus. But what do I mean by that? So before conditioning, this is the animal. This is you, this is me, this is my dog. We've got an unconditioned stimulus and a response to that. Now, the response to the unconditioned stimulus, we're going to call an unconditioned response or UR. So we have an existing US, we have an existing response. Because that response is to the US, we're going to call it a UR, an unconditioned response. Now we have another stimulus. There's a neutral stimulus, which doesn't get anything useful out. It's ignored. So this is like, I might have trained my dog already to sit when I do this. So I do this and he sits. And I say, good boy, Dexter. And then I want now tend to do it when I just say the word sit. And so now I say the word sit and I pair it with the hand signal. And eventually I cannot do the hand signal and just say sit, and he's just going to sit. I've now copied a response from one stimulus to another. I copied the response from the hand signal to the voice signal. That's what goes on during conditioning. So if I do that here, conditioning is now I've turned the neutral stimulus into the conditioned stimulus. So same response, but now you get that response in two different ways. You get that response through either the existing response, or you get that response through what used to be ignored. That's classical conditioning. So questions about that? That makes sense. Copying a response from one thing to another. We're going to map this to supervised learning in a second. Okay. So conditioning copies an existing response to previously neutral ignored stimulus. That's the summary. All right. Skinner, B.F. Skinner, thought that this was boring. He said most behavior in nature is not like this. So we really want to see how behaviors emerge over time naturally. And so what is that process like? And so Skinner then came up with operant conditioning, this paradigm. So this is an idea of how do you get new behaviors or a change in the frequency of behaviors by reinforcement or punishment. So the idea here is we have an operant. So Skinner's word, an operant is a voluntary, emphasis on voluntary behavior subject to modification based on consequences. So he liked to talk about operants and their consequences. And those consequences are reinforcement and punishment. So an animal does a behavior, that's the operant. And after doing that behavior, it either gets punished or reinforced, and that will change how frequently it does the operant. That's where that comes from. And so this is voluntary. This is very different than classical. So we're not asking it to do a behavior. We're not saying, Dexter, sit. We're just waiting for Dexter to do something, like, or Dexter to not do something. So we watch for the voluntary behaviors, like if I notice that my dog goes over and jumps up on the countertop, I might say no. I might pull him off the countertop, those sorts of things. Or if he goes over to the counter, sniffs, but then doesn't jump, I might give him a treat. So in that case, I'm not stimulating him to do a behavior. I'm watching for behaviors that are happening voluntarily and then rewarding them or punishing them. That is the operant. In classical conditioning, what those are called are respondents. So an operant comes first and has consequences. A respondent comes second after stimuli. Okay, so the two types of consequences are reinforcement and punishment. Reinforcement increases the health of the frequency, punishment decreases the frequency. And then of both of these, we refer to them as either being positive or negative. So a positive reinforcement means after you get the behavior, you give a good thing. Positive punishment is after you get the behavior you don't want, you apply the punishment. But you could also imagine negative versions of that. So if you're constantly giving the good thing and then a bad behavior happens, you can take that away. And that would be an example of negative reinforcement. You can also have negative punishment. So you're constantly punishing and then a good behavior happens, you take the punishment away. So there's four different ways you can apply these different things to change the frequency of behaviors. And we're going to relate this to reinforcement learning. Okay, any questions about operant conditioning? Okay, so machine learning then, so bringing it all back to the machines. So in machine learning, the paradigms we have are unsupervised learning. So this is learning in response to a passive experience. And so you give a bunch of data to the machine, you say, make something, sense of this data. The machine comes out and it says, I noticed that these individuals all are similar in this particular way. These individuals are similar in this particular way, and it naturally clusters them. And we'll talk more about this, in a later unit here, but, clustering, multidimensional scaling, dimensionality reduction, these are all examples of unsupervised learning. You don't tell it what you want, you just give it data and you have it somehow make sense of that data. This is just like non-associative Hebbian learning. So if you were to build this on a biological framework, you could just implement it with Hebbian learning, fire together, wire together, and we'll see that. When we get to spiking neural networks, you can make you can actually make things that look like classifiers, but basically things that cluster patterns together using just plain old Hebbian learning. So then the next step is self-supervised learning. So self-supervised learning is another unsupervised learning, but you have internal rewards. And we think that something goes on in the brain like this as well, where you make predictions. So in self-supervised learning, for example, ChatGPT and BERT, which is sort of inside Gemini, inside Google's transformer, they in early in their development, they had a self-supervised learning point where they basically gave them a bunch of text, and they did things like randomly blacked out words in the text they were given, and then so they had to decide which word to black out, and then tried to predict what that word was. So they gave themselves little tests that made themselves better at learning. So that's an example of a self-supervised learning where they were sort of giving them internal feedback. Like they know what the answer is because they blacked it out. They can look behind what they blacked out and they can then see how good was my prediction in order to predict that word. And then they can train themselves. That's what we mean by self-supervised learning. You don't provide any exterior rewards, it's all internal. We think that the brain forms even the evolution of color. Like your eye, you can see in color. Those of you who can see in color, you've probably seen at least probably nobody here sees in black and white. But if you look at the signals that come out the back of your eye, it's not actually clear how this you're seeing in color. And we think that predictive models generate error signals inside your head that eventually the only way they can make sense of the world is by creating color concepts. And this is sort of an idea behind self-supervised learning. So with that in mind, we think of this as latent learning. That's the biological paradigm that's built on top of Hebbian learning with internal circuits that aggregate error. And that's what creates this circuit that you can build for self-supervised learning. Sort of the next step down then is reinforcement learning. So here, where you actually do provide that external feedback where you say, that was good, that was bad. You got the robot moving around. It doesn't know what it's supposed to do, but when it does bad things, you shock it. When it does good things, you give it points. And so it learns which actions lead to desirable outcomes by incorporating external error signals. We tie that to operant conditioning, which we think we can build in biology from Hebbian learning plus externally triggered neuromodulation. So by modulating dopamine, these reward signals, you can make it more likely or less likely to learn certain associations, operant conditioning there. And then finally, supervised learning, sort of the most popular when we talk about our modern neural networks, learn to associate neutral stimuli with meaningful response, incorporates external specialized feedback on what was correct. No, that was the wrong. This is the right. And we view this as sort of classical conditioning with Hebbian learning plus structured feedback. So if we're thinking about, I've got a neural network, here is the X. I should get a response Y out of the neural network. The untrained neural network gives me a garbage response when I give it X. So then I provide it that feedback that says, no, I want you to actually produce, I know you can produce the Y response. Right now, you're producing the Y response for some random input, but I want you to produce the Y response for this input right here. So that's why you think supervised learning, you take a response that the neural network can generate, and you then move it to an input that it currently is not generating it for. That's supervised learning. And we think we can build that again with a structured feedback signal from outputs to inputs, and then Hebbian learning to freeze everything in place. So we think that, these learning paradigms that come out of biology can all be viewed as directly related to the four major learning paradigms in machine learning. And this is good because if we do want to build neuromorphic hardware, if we really want to build hardware that's based off of how neurons actually work, then it's nice that we have sort of a blueprint for how we might design those networks in order to do all of those things. So this is meant for me to be your translation table for if you do find yourself someday with an Intel Loihi chip or something like that, and you're trying to do a particular task, which is well defined in the machine learning literature, how do you then implement that with your neuromorphic hardware? Well, how did biology do it? And this is how we think biology did it. Okay, so takeaway messages. This is my last slide. Basically what I just said, each form of machine learning can be implemented on a biological substrate, combining Hebbian learning, not backpropagation, which we will talk about, Hebbian learning and either nothing else for unsupervised, internal error for self-supervised, externally triggered neuromodulation for reinforcement, and externally structured feedback signals, external error for supervised learning. So basically, you got your base learning mechanism, Hebbian learning, fire together, wire together, combined with special circuitry, and you can do everything you can do in machine learning with these neural hardwares. So then once you've got it in the Hebbian learning, then if your Hebbian learning mechanism has a forgetting mechanism, because that's what neurons do, you can then add it up. You can put your neural network to sleep later, and you can then consolidate those short-term memories into long-term memories for lifelong learning. And that's sort of the story. So next time, basically, we're going to go back. We're going to start with this. We're going to turn it into that. And then we're going to turn that into those things. That's kind of our map. So I've got a minute or two left. Any questions about any of that? All right. Well, I'll be here for a minute or two, and that's all I've got for you. So we'll see you next time to start into things that hopefully look more familiar.